The political landscape of our time is dominated by the idea that nation-states are autonomous, sovereign societies in which religion plays a minor role at best. Religion may influence some aspects of culture, but affiliation with a religious group is voluntary, and it's distinct from the rest of society. What we need to understand, if we're going to be objective in our study of history, is that that idea simply did not exist in Europe during the Middle Ages. In the 9th century, the Frank king Charles the Great, better known as Charlemagne, sought to make Augustine's vision of society in his magnum opus, The City of God, a reality. He merged church and state, fusing a new political-religious alliance. His was a conscious effort to merge the Roman Catholic Church with what was left of the old Roman political house, creating a hybrid Holy Roman Empire. And the product was medieval European Christendom. Now, how did it come about that Jesus' statement that his kingdom was not of this world could be so massively reworked? Let's find out. 300 years after the fall of the Western Empire to the Goths, the ideal of empire continued to fire the imaginations of the people of Europe. Though the barbarians were divided into several groups and remained at constant war with each other, the longing for peace and unity that had marked the region under the Roman eagle held a powerful attraction. Many look forward to the day when a new empire would appear. Just as the Eastern Empire centered at Constantinople saw itself as Rome still, the vestiges of the Western Empire, along with their German neighbors, hoped the empire would strike back and rise again. By merging the Roman and Germanic religions, customs, and peoples, the Franks under Clovis became the odds-on favorite to accomplish what many hoped for. But Clovis's dynasty began to fall apart not long after he passed from the scene. His descendants were at odds with each other, vying for preeminence, and they became adept at intrigue and treachery. The power vacuum created by their squabbles gave room for wealthy aristocrats to gain power. Like dogs fighting over a scrap of food while they're busy snarling and snapping at each other, a cat comes and quietly steals away what they're fighting over. And so it was with Clovis's descendants, the Merovingians. While they fought each other, the landed nobility quietly stole more and more of their authority. Among these emerging aristocrats was one who worked his way into the heart of power to become the most influential figure in the kingdom. He was called the major domo, that is, the mayor of the palace. Now, the major domo was the real power behind the Frankish throne. He ran the kingdom while the king served as little more than a ceremonial figurehead. The idea was that the son of the previous king wasn't necessarily the one most fit to rule. So while the title went legally to him, the day-to-day business of running the realm was better served by another with the skills to get the job done. In 680, Pepin II became major domo for the Franks. He made no pretense of his desire to supplant the Merovingian line with his own as the de facto rulers. He took the title of Duke and Prince of the Franks and made moves to ensure that his line would eventually sit the throne. His son, Charles Martel, became major domo in 715. Now, Charles allowed the Merovingian kings to retain their title, but as little more than figureheads. What catapulted Charles to the throne was his defeat of the Muslims in 732. In 711, a Muslim army from North Africa called the Moors invaded Spain and rolled back the weak kingdom of the Visigoths by 718. With the Iberian Peninsula under their control, the Moors began raiding across the Pyrenees into southern Gaul. Now, until this time, the Muslims had advanced at a steady pace out of the Middle East, across North Africa, and then into Europe. It seemed that no one in the West could stop them, and the fear of their infidel hordes running amok through the lands of Christendom was a terror. In 732, Charles led the Franks against a Moor raiding party near Tours, deep inside the Franks' land. He inflicted such heavy losses, the Moors retreated to Spain and were never again a major threat to Western Europe. For this and his other conquests, Charles was called Martel, the Hammer. Martel's son, Pepin III, also known as Pepin the Short, considered it time to make the power of the Frank major domo more official. Now, why not give the title of king to the guy who was actually ruling, instead of some royal spoiled brat who thought armies were just large toys to play with? Pepin III asked Pope Zachary for a ruling, saying that whoever actually wielded the power was the legal ruler. He got what he wanted, promptly deposed the last Merovingian king, Childeric III, and was crowned the first of the Carolingian kings by the Bishop of Mainz in 751. Childeric was quietly shuffled off to a monastery where he was told to mind his manners or he'd wake up dead one day. Then, 3 years after Pepin's coronation, Pope Stephen II himself blessed him by making the trip from Rome to Paris and personally anointing Pepin as the chosen of the Lord. Now, both Popes Zachary and Stephen were eager to shore up the alliance with the Franks that had begun with Clovis because of the emerging problem with the Lombards. They'd already conquered Ravenna, the center of Byzantine power in Italy. The Lombards demanded tribute from the Pope and threatened to take Rome if it wasn't paid. With Pepin's coronation, the church at Rome secured his promise of protection and his pledge to give the Pope the territory of Ravenna once it was recovered. In 756, the Franks forced the Lombards to surrender several of their Italian conquests, and Pepin kept his promise to give Ravenna to the Pope. This was known as the Donation of Pepin and came to be called the Papal States. This made the Pope a temporal ruler over a strip of land cutting across Italy. This alliance between the Franks and the Church at Rome, or more properly, between the Carolingian kings and the popes, had a dramatic impact on the course of European politics for centuries to come. It sped up the separation of the Latin and Greek church by giving the popes an ally to replace the Byzantines. And it created the Papal States, which will play a major role in Italian politics all the way up until the late 19th century. But one of the most significant issues was that with the popes taking a hand in anointing kings, the stage was set for the eventual vying for power between church and state, pope and emperor. The question became, who was really in charge? The pope, who by reason of setting the crown on the king's head sanctioned his rule? Or the king, whose armies were the enforcement end of the pope's staff and protected him from enemies? Do popes make kings or do kings make popes? Fire up the medieval merry-go-round. It was Pepin's third son who took all that his father and grandfather had done and put the cap on it. His name also was Charles, Charles the Great, known to us as Charlemagne. When Charlemagne succeeded his father in 768, he had a far-reaching vision of making Central Europe into a new empire, similar to the Golden Age of Rome, but this time enlightened by Christianity. To accomplish this vision, he had three objectives. The first of those was to boost the Franks militarily so that they might dominate Europe. Second, to secure an alliance with the church to unite Europe under one faith. And third, to make this European base an intellectual center. Charlemagne's success in achieving these objectives set the course for Europe for the next 1,000 years. Charles the Great was a big man. At 6'3", he was a full foot taller than the average at that time. But to those who met him, he seemed even bigger because he was one of those people who had an extra dose of gravitas. He was skilled at arms and was always at the head of the army when they went into battle, which he led the Franks in every year. The Merovingians had wasted the strength of the Franks in incessant civil wars. Charlemagne united the Franks and set them on the task of conquest. He took advantage of feuds among the Muslim Moors in Spain, and in 778 across the Pyrenees in an attempt to reclaim the Iberian Peninsula. His first campaign was met with minor success, but later expeditions drove the Moors back to the Ebro River and established a frontier known as the Spanish March, centered at Barcelona. Then Charlemagne conquered the Bavarians and the Saxons, last of the independent Germanic tribes. He ruthlessly attempted to stamp out the residue of Germanic paganism by passing harsh laws, such as, well, eating meat during Lent and cremating the dead or pretending to be baptized. These became offenses punishable by death. The kingdom's eastern frontier was continually threatened by Asiatic nomads related to the Huns, known as the Slavs and the Avars. Charlemagne decimated the Avars and set up his own military province in the Danube Valley to guard against future plundering. He called this the Eastern March, later known as Austria. Then, like his father before him, Charlemagne sought to take a hand in Italian politics. The Lombards invaded that territory that Pepin had given to the church, and so in 774, at the Pope's urging, Charlemagne once again defeated the Lombards and proclaimed himself their king. The Lombards' campaigns and conquests made it clear that the popes needed protection. Only one military and political power had that ability, the Frank king. And so Charlemagne, on the other hand, needed divine sanction to accomplish his goal of uniting Europe. Only one authority possessed the religious authority to do that, and that was the Pope. Can you see where this is headed? On April 25th of 799, which was St. Mark's Day, it was a day that was set aside for repentance and prayer. It seemed the right thing to do since Italy had been, well, stricken by numerous problems, including plague and pestilence. So Pope Leo III led a procession through Rome, beseeching God's forgiveness and blessing. The procession wound through the middle of the street to St. Peter's, and as it turned a corner, armed men rushed at the Pope. They drove off his attendants and then pulled Leo off his horse, carting him off to a monastery favorable to their cause, that being their loyalty to the previous Pope, Adrian I. They charged Leo with perjury and adultery. Leo's supporters sleuthed the kidnappers, tracked him down, and rescued him. This created a furor that sparked ongoing riots that could not be quelled. So Pope Leo once again sent for Charlemagne. The king crossed the Alps with an army, determined to settle the Pope's problems once and for all. He put down the unrest and in December presided over a large assembly of bishops, nobles, diplomats, and the malcontents. In other words, anyone who considered themselves someone and held a hand in the political game was in attendance. Then the Pope, wielding a Bible, took an oath swearing innocence in all of the charges against him. That brought the mutiny against him to an effective end, but it set the stage for a far more momentous development. 2 days later, Christmas Day of AD 800, Charlemagne arrived at St. Peter's with a large retinue for Christmas service. Pope Leo sang the Mass, and as the king knelt in prayer in front of St. Peter's crypt, the Pope approached the kneeling monarch carrying a golden crown. Leo placed it on Charlemagne's head as the congregation cried out, "To Charles, the most pious, crowned Augustus by God, to the great peacemaking emperor, long life and victory." The Pope then prostrated himself. Charlemagne, king of the Franks, had just become the first king of the Holy Roman Empire. After his coronation, Charlemagne said that he didn't know that it had been planned by Pope Leo. If it was indeed a surprise, he got over the shock right quick. He shot off dispatches to the lands under his control to inform them that he was large and in charge. Each missive began with the words, quote, "Charles, by the will of God, Roman Emperor, Augustus, in the year of our consulship, 1, unquote. He required an oath be taken to him as Caesar by all officers, whether religious or civil. He sent ambassadors to soothe the inevitable wrath of the emperor in Constantinople. Now, worth noting is how this coronation ceremony in St. Peter's demonstrate the still keen memory of the Roman Empire in Europe. His quick emergence as the recognized leader of a large part of the continent revealed a strong desire to reestablish a political unity that had been absent for almost four centuries. But Charlemagne's coronation also launched a long-standing contest, one we'd not expect, since it was, after all, the Pope who crowned him. That competition was between the revived empire and the Roman Church. In the medieval world, church and state were two realms comprising what we call Christendom, a hybrid word drawn from the words kingdom and Christianity. The medieval church represented Christian society aimed at acquiring spiritual blessings, while the medieval state existed to safeguard civil justice and tranquility. Under the medieval system, both church and state were supposed to exist side by side in a harmonious relationship, each focused on gaining the good of mankind, but in different spheres, you know, the spiritual and the civil. In reality, it rarely worked that way. The Pope and the Emperor were usually contestants in a real-life Game of Thrones. The abiding question was, does the church rule the state or the state the church? This contest was played out on countless fields, large and small, throughout the Middle Ages. Charlemagne left no doubt about where sovereignty lay during his reign. He provided Europe a colossal father figure as the first Holy Roman Emperor. Everyone was answerable to him. To solve the problem of supervising local officials in his expansive realm, Charlemagne established a policy creating what were called the Missi Dominici, the king's envoys. These were pairs of officials, a bishop and a noble, who traveled the realm to check on local officials. Even the Pope was kept under the watchful imperial eye. Though Charlemagne occasionally used the title emperor in official documents, he usually declined it because it appeared to register his acceptance of what the Pope had done at his coronation. Charlemagne considered that dangerous, that the Pope was now in a position to make an emperor. The concern was the one who can make an emperor can unmake him. Charles thought it ought to be the other way around, that emperors selected and sanctioned popes. In truth, what Pope Leo III did on Christmas Day of the year 800, when he placed that crown on Charlemagne's head, was just really a final flourish of what was already a well-established fact, that Charles was the king of the Franks. The coronation was the cherry on the top of a sundae that had already been made by Charles the Great. Charlemagne's vision included making Europe an intellectual center. He launched a revival of learning and the arts referred to by historians as the Carolingian Renaissance. Charlemagne required monasteries to have a school for the education of boys in grammar, math, and singing. At his capital of Aachen, he built a school for the education of the royal court. The famous English scholar Alcuin headed the school and began the difficult task of reviving learning in the early Middle Ages by authoring the first textbooks in grammar, rhetoric, and logic. It was Charlemagne's emphasis on education, I think, that really proved to be his enduring legacy. He sent agents far and wide to secure every work of the classical age that they could find. They returned to Aachen, in the monastery schools, where they were translated into Latin, and that's why Latin becomes the language of scholarship in the ages to come. It was helped along by Charlemagne's insistence that a standard script be developed, known to us as Carolingian minuscule. Now, scholars all across Western Europe could read the same materials because a consistent script was being used for the Latin letters. This became one of the most important elements in making the Renaissance possible. Now, few historians deny Charlemagne's massive impact on European history, and thereby the history of the modern world. The center of Western civilization shifted from the Mediterranean to Northern Europe. After 300 years of virtual chaos, Charles the Great restored a measure of law and order. His sponsorship of the intellectual arts laid a heritage of culture for future generations, and the imperial ideal that he revived persisted as a political force in Europe until 1806, when the Holy Roman Empire was terminated by another self-styled emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte. In reality, the peace of Charlemagne's rule was short-lived. His empire was simply too vast, its nobility too powerful to be held together once his dominating personality was removed. Like Clovis before him, Charlemagne's successors were weak, and the empire degenerated into a confusion of civil wars and new invasions. The Northmen began their incessant raiding forays, called Going a Viking, so we know them as the Vikings. They set sail from Scandinavia in their shallow-hulled longships, able to sail up rivers and deep inland, where they raided villages, towns, and, well, any other unfortunate hamlets that they came on. These raids of Vikings forced the native peoples to surrender, first their lands and then their persons, to the counts, dukes, and other local lords who began to multiply during this time, in return for the protection from the raiders. It's not difficult to see how the process of feudalism developed. Common people needed protection from the raiders, whoever they were. But the king and his army, they were a long way away. It could take weeks, months even, to send a message and get help and reply. In the meantime, the Vikings are right here, right now. I mean, see him? Yeah, that blonde, long-haired giant berserker with that two-headed battle axe is about to crash through my door. What good is the king and his army in Aachen or in Paris? No, what I need is someone near with enough men at his call, you know, enough trained and armed soldiers, that is, who can turn away a long ship's crew of 50 berserkers. How expensive is it to hire, train, outfit, and keep a group of soldiers? You know, figure two of them for every Viking. Who can field an army of 100 professional soldiers? Well, the nearest count is 20 minutes away, and he only has a half dozen hired men for protection. But that count's a smart guy. And he realizes that he's the only one in the area to do what needs to be done. And so he goes to 25 of the area's farmers and he says, hey, listen, I'll protect you. But to do that, I need to field an army of 100 men. That's very expensive to do. So here's what we need. I will, in exchange for the protection that I provide, you give me the title to your land. You live on it and continue to work it. You keep half the yield of all the farm products. The rest is mine. And for that, I and my army will keep you safe. You know, when the choice is either yield to the count or face the longships on your own, there is not much choice. And so feudalism, with the systems of serfs, counts, barons, dukes, and earls, began. Central to feudalism was the personal bond between lord and vassals. In the ceremony that was known as the Act of Homage, the vassal knelt before his lord and promised to be his man. And the oath of loyalty that followed, called fealty, the vassal swore on a Bible or a sacred object such as a cross. And then in the ritual of investiture, a spear, a glove, or a bit of straw was handed to the vassal to signify his control, but not his ownership, over his allotted piece of the lord's realm. The feudal contract between lord and vassal was sacred, binding on both parties. Breaking the pledge was a major felony because it was the basic bond of medieval society. It was thought that to break the rules of feudal society was to imperil all of society, a civilization itself. The lord was obliged to give his vassals protection and justice. Vassals not only worked the land for the lord, but they also gave 40 days without pay each year to serve as a militia in the event that it was an all-out war. But only 40 days, because as farmers they needed to be home to work their lands and tend their herds. For the most part, this system worked pretty well, as long as the lord treated his vassals well. What became a problem was when lords got greedy and decided to mobilize their army and militia to make a land grab on a neighboring lord. Ideally, feudalism was supposed to be for protection, not for conquest. As the church was so much a part of medieval life, it couldn't escape being included in the feudal system. Since the Vikings were equal opportunity raiders, they had no qualms whatever about breaking into churches, convents, and monasteries, putting priests and monks to the sword, raping nuns, and absconding with church treasures. This meant that the church turned to local lords for protection as well. Bishops and abbots also became vassals, receiving from the lord a specific region over which their authority lay. And in return, they had to provide some service to the lord. The monasteries might produce, you know, different goods, which they would use to pay his tribute. Priests were often made the special private clergy for the noble's family. This became a problem when loyalty to the lord conflicted with a ruling from or mission assigned by the church. You know, who were the abbots, priests, and bishops to obey? The duke, who's 10 minutes from here, or the pope, who's weeks away in Rome? In the 10th and early 11th centuries, the popes were in no position to challenge anyone. The office fell into decay after becoming a prize sought by the Roman nobility. What made the later Middle Ages so complex was the massive intrigue that took place between nobles and church officials who learned how to play the feudal game. Society was governed by strict rules, but there were always ways to get around them. And when one couldn't get around them, if you had enough money or a big enough army, why bother with the rules? You know, when you can write your own or pay the rule interpreters to interpret them in your favor. We know how complex political maneuvering can be today. Compared to Europe in the High Middle Ages, we're infants in a nursery. Don't forget, it was that era and system that produced a guy named Machiavelli. Now, on a positive note, while there were a few corrupt church officials who saw religious office as, you know, just another way to gain political power and wealth, most bishops, priests, and abbots sought to influence for the better the behavior of the feudal nobles, so vassals would be taken care of. In time, their work added Christian virtues to a code of knightly conduct that came to be called chivalry. Now, to be clear, chivalry ended up being more an ideal than a practice. A few knights and members of the nobility embraced the chivalric ideals, but others just took advantage of those who sought to live by them. Knights in shining armor riding off on dangerous quests to rescue fair maidens. That makes for fun stories, but it's not the way chivalry played out in history. It was an ideal that the church worked hard to instill in the increasingly brutal feudal age. Bishops tried to impose limitations on warfare. In fact, in the 11th century, they inaugurated a couple of initiatives called the Peace of God and the Truce of God. Now, the Peace of God banned anyone who pillaged sacred places or refused to spare non-combatants from being able to participate in communion or receive any of the other sacraments. The Truce of God set up periods of time when no fighting was allowed. It's just kind of funny. For instance, no combat could be conducted from sunset on Wednesday to sunrise on Monday and during other special seasons such as Lent. Now, it was good ideas, but both rules were conveniently set aside when they were contrary to some knight's desire. During the 11th century, the controversy between church and state, it centered on the problem of what's called investiture. And this goes back now to something that had been in tension for centuries and was renewed in the crowning of Charlemagne. It was supposed to be that bishops and abbots were appointed to their office by the church. Their spiritual authority was invested in them by a pope or an archbishop. But because bishops and abbots had taken on certain feudal responsibilities, they were invested with civil authority by the local noble, sometimes by the king himself. Now, problems arose when a king refused to invest a bishop because said bishop was more interested in church affairs than the king's. He wanted someone more compliant to his agenda. Well, the church, of course, wanted leaders who would look out for her interests. It was a constant game of brinkmanship, in which whatever institution held the most influence had a say in who led churches and monasteries. In places like Germany, where the king was strong, bishops and abbots were his men. Where the church had greater influence, it was the bishops and the abbots who dominated political affairs. But that was the controversy of the 11th century. The church of the 10th could see that the way things were headed in its affiliation with the throne and knew that it was not prepared to challenge kings and emperors. It needed to set its own house in order because things had slipped badly for a couple hundred years. Moral corruption had infected large portions of the clergy and learning had sunk to a low. Many clergy were illiterate, marked by grave superstitions. It was a time for renewal and reform. And that was led by the Benedictine Order at Cluny, founded in 910. From their original monastery in eastern France, these Benedictines exerted a powerful impulse for reform within the feudal church. The Clunaic program began as a monastic reform movement, but spread to the European church as a whole. It influenced the celibacy of priests and abolished the purchase of church offices, a corrupt practice called simony. The goal of the Clunaic reformers was to free the church from the secular control and return it to the Pope's authority. Nearly 300 monasteries were freed from control by the nobles, and in 1059, the papacy itself was delivered from secular interference. This came about by the creation of the College of Cardinals, which from then on selected the Pope. The man who led the much-needed reform of the papacy was an archdeacon named Hildebrand. He was elected Pope in 1073 and given the title Gregory VII. He claimed more power for the papal office than had been known before and worked for the creation of a Christian empire under the Pope's control. Rather than equality between church and state, Gregory said that spiritual power was supreme and therefore trumped the temporal power of nobles and kings. In 1075, he banned investiture of bishops by civil officials, and he threatened to excommunicate anyone who performed it, as well as any clergy who submitted to it. This was a virtual declaration of war on Europe's rulers, since most of them practiced investiture. The climax to the struggle between Pope Gregory and Europe's nobility, that took place in his clash with the Emperor Henry IV. Now, the Pope accused Henry of simony in appointing his own choice to be the Archbishop of Milan. Gregory summoned Henry to Rome to explain his conduct. Henry refused to go, but convened a synod of German bishops in 1076 that declared Gregory a usurper and unfit to be Pope. The synod declared, quote, "Wherefore, henceforth, we renounce now and for the future all obedience to you," unquote. In retaliation, Pope Gregory excommunicated Henry and deposed him, absolving his subjects from their oaths of allegiance. Now remember how sacred and firm those feudal oaths between lord and vassals were. The Pope, who was supposed to be God's representative on earth, sent a message to all of Henry's subjects saying, not only was Henry booted out of the church and so destined to the eternal flames of hell, he was no longer king or emperor. So their bonds to him were dissolved. Furthermore, to continue to give allegiance to Henry was to defy the Pope, who opens and closes the door to heaven. And you don't really want to do that, do you? Can you see where all of this is going? Henry may have an army, but that army has to eat, and if the peasants and serfs won't work, that army falls apart. Henry was convinced by the German nobles who revolted against him to make peace with Pope Gregory. He appeared before the Pope in January of 1077. Dressed as a penitent, the emperor stood barefoot in the snow for 3 days and begged forgiveness until, in Gregory's words, quote, "we loosed the chain of the anathema and at length received him into the lap of the Holy Mother Church," unquote. This dramatic humiliation of an emperor did not forever end the contest between the throne and the Pope. but the church made progress toward freeing itself from interference by the nobles. The problem of investiture was settled in 1122 by a compromise known as the Concordat of Worms. The church kept the right to appoint the holder of the church offices. Then the nobles endorsed them. The popes who followed Gregory added little to the authority of the papacy. They also insisted that society was organized under the pope as its visible head, and he was guarded against all possibility of error by the Apostle Peter being perpetually present in his successors. During the Middle Ages, for the first time, Europe became conscious of itself as a unity. It was the church that facilitated that identity. Though it struggled with the challenge of how to wield power without being corrupted by it, the church gained a level of influence over the lives of men and women that, for the most part, it used to benefit society. You know, we're used to seeing priests and bishops of the medieval era as modern literature and movies cast them. It's far more interesting to make them out to be, you know, villains and scoundrels instead of godly servants of Christ who lived virtuous lives. A survey of movies and novels written about the Middle Ages shows that churchmen are nearly always cast in one of two ways. The best are naive but illiterate bumblers, while the worst are conniving criminals who hide their wickedness behind a cross. Well, there were certainly a handful of each of those two typecasts. The vast majority of priests and monks were simply godly lovers of Jesus who worked tirelessly to bring his love and truth to the people of their day. But guys like that just don't make for very interesting characters in a murder mystery set in a medieval monastery.